Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Well, today it's how one man set out to learn all he could about wine by going to the sources, the winemakers. We talk with Neil Rosenthal, who in 30 years of working this way has become one of our most respected wine merchants and a famous contrarian, too. Travel and Leisure's Anya von Bremsen talks how to eat well for next to nothing in today's Europe. Then it's the Blue Zone, perhaps the formula for living long and living well. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's do this number, starting off with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, it may come as a surprise to the people of Texas and New Mexico and even Cincinnati, but the chili capital of the civilized universe is Springfield, Illinois.
If you even whisper this in some place like Santa Fe, New Mexico, they're going to ride you out of town on a rail.
Well, the chili capital of the civilized universe, according to the state legislature of Illinois, is Springfield.
Oh, they said that about themselves.
They said
I
that about
you were
no, I am not
that.
Declaring this.
Okay.
This is congressional decree.
Well,
and furthermore,
we know how honest politicians are. So
don't go there.
Furthermore,
James.
Springfield declared that the only correct spelling of chili is C-H-I-L-L-I.
I kind of agree with that.
I have never heard of that spelling, but that's beside... Now, wait a minute. Where is this all coming from?
It's all coming from the fact that Springfield, Illinois, happens to be the home of a number of places devoted exclusively to serving chili. Foremost among them is Joe Rogers' Original Recipe Chili Parlor, which has been there since 1945. It's a real diner kind of a place. It's a modern place. They've remodeled since 1945. Uh-huh. But you sit at the counter and you order your chili in any configuration you want. In
like
other
what?
Words,
like
when you
what?
Say chili, all you get
is
meat.
Red stuff.
Just meat.
Okay.
And it's hardly even red. Now, if you want beans, you can get beans. If you want extra beans, you can get that. You can get beans without meat, if that's what you want.
Oh,
and it's kind of like Cincinnati, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was thinking.
It's similar, but there's no spaghetti involved.
Oh, okay.
Well, purists, right again.
Yeah.
But wait a minute. Is this spicy? I mean, is there seasoning?
It depends.
There are five grades of heat.
This is all very customized, you have to understand.
So the mild one is just, you know, is kind of comfort food, Midwestern heartland comfort food. The ultra hot one, known as the JR Special, is known to regulars as Firebrand. And if you eat an entire bowl of ultra-hot Joe Rogers chili, you get your name posted on the wall. We did not try that ourselves. We got the penultimate heat one, and that was pretty hot.
I kept asking for the hot one, and they kept looking at me and saying, no, you don't want it. And I said, yes, I do. No, you don't. So, you know, I mean, I think they kind of scope you out and decide if you're up for that or not.
But the big question, is this good?
It's pretty good. I mean, it's not Texas chili. It's not exotic. It's not purists chili, but it's that wonderful sort of comfort food, almost casserole-like dish.
And you know what? Why it's interesting to us is because, as you said earlier, I mean, Texas, New Mexico, that's really where, you know, everybody knows that chili is from. And there's a whole kind of Midwestern school of chili that pretty much is under the radar.
I have a theory. I think the whole point of this is that chili is the catch-all. It's a dish that for a world of people, it can suit individual tastes or regional tastes, but it's accessible to everybody.
Yes. Well, certainly at Joe Rogers, where they customize it for you.
I love that.
You can have it anywhere.
Can I just say parenthetically, Lynn, I have something that must be said parenthetically. If you're going to Springfield, Illinois to eat C-H-I-L-L-I at Joe Rogers, you also have to stop at Cozy Dog, which is one of the original corn dogs in this country, going back to the days of Route 66 traveling through Springfield. Originally, Cozy Dog was known as Krusty Kerr until they decided they needed a better name for it. But it's a great, great corn dog in Springfield.
Rabbit dog.
Yes.
Krusty Kerr. I love that.
I think we can stop now.
Okay. All right.
Take care, Lynn.
You too.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. Driving in my Malibu.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. With the dollar bottoming out, you may be looking at that European vacation you booked with a little trepidation. All those food fantasies are probably toast. Well, not necessarily. Food and Travel Authority Anya von Bremsen has been doing some reality checks across the continent. Anya, it's good to have you back.
So delighted to be here.
You know, Anya, sandwiches, I mean, I think of you writing about restaurants that are cutting the edge, you know, white tablecloths, upscale. This is new territory for you, isn't it?
Well, actually, you know, street food, ethnic food has always been my first love. And, you know, one does what one has to do. One goes to white tablecloth restaurant. Life can be unfair and difficult sometimes.
I know.
But I have to say I've never had so much fun as I did in researching the story on the best sandwiches in Europe. I mean, there's something visceral, you know, about tucking in into a wonderful piece of bread with some amazing filling. And, you know, the main thing that I have discovered, well, that I've kind of known, but was very apparent, is how different American and European sensibilities are. When you think of a great American sandwich, what do you think? You think of a behemoth, you know, jaw-challenging, you know, 7 pounds of pastrami, trimmings,
yeah,
mayo. More is more mentality. What you have in the great European sandwich, whether it's a classic baguette sandwich, whether it's a great panino, or whether it's a German open-faced sandwich, is how little they put on it. It's all about two ingredients that are presented in a kind of perfect architecture.
Huh.
You know, a sandwich that doesn't have tomato, mayo, whatever, soggy stuff on it, you know, doesn't get mushy. It's actually been amazing, and I've just discovered some absolute masterpieces.
Huh. So tell us, the finds.
Well, I have to say that my favorite thing in life, probably at this very minute, is the pizza bianca, you know, the undressed focaccia-like pizza at Forno Roscioli in Rome.
Oh.
And, you know, this is like top-level artisanal stuff, you know, it rises with special yeast, you know, low fermentation, is baked in a very special way, and it's just, you know, both chewy and bready a little bit and bubbly. And what you do is essentially you construct your own panino by buying some mortadella from a great Bolognese producer called Pasquini.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go, you know, to Campo de Fiore and chew on your sandwich, and it's just sheer bliss.
And a pizza bianca, maybe you better explain what that is, because I think a lot of people think that that's with cheese and that kind of thing. But I don't think in this case it is.
Pizza bianca is a particular Roman variation on pizza, which is more like what we know as focaccia. It's essentially undressed pizza dough that's just sprinkled, slathered with olive oil a little bit, and sprinkled with coarse salt.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And so it's essentially, it's you know, Rome's basic sandwich bread, and very traditionally it comes with ricotta or mortadella. And when it's good, as it is only in a few places in Rome. I mean, Roman cuisine is really going downhill a little bit, but that place is amazing.
So, Anya, I just have to know, most innovative sandwich, is it Spain with all the new stuff that's going on there?
Yes, absolutely, because Spain has a very deep and serious tradition of the bocadillo, you know, the local sandwich. Again, very simple and a simple, you know, in its basic variant. And, you know, the chefs are just running with it. And one of my favorite places is called Paninoteca De, and it's a mini chain in Madrid, very trendy. It's the sandwiches are designed by Madrid superstar, two Michelin star chef, Sergio Arola. And, you know, there we get into innovations. For instance, you might have a ciabatta bread with a poached quail egg, camembert cream, a little bit of potato chips just for crunch, and a little bit of truffle oil. But it's not deconstructed. I mean, I could tell you about deconstructed sandwiches also, but maybe on another show. But it's certainly a haute cuisine.
What about Germany?
Germany, that wonderful bread. My favorite place in Berlin, you know, where I could just spend hours and hours, is a department store, KDW. And like Japanese department stores with a food floor, their food floor is just a showcase of absolutely the latest fashion from, you know, the best cheeses, the most interesting breads. And there is a herring stall where they do Fischbrötchen, you know, fish sandwiches. You know, there's a guy that looks like a sushi master. You know, he arranges the herring. There are other smoked fishes. And again, it's a sandwich with a perfect architecture. It's a very crusty roll with this buttery, wonderful herring. And essentially with hamburger trimmings, you know, a wisp of onion, a little bit of tomato, and a pickle. And, you know, you get a glass of Riesling you just claim a stool and you look at Berlin. And again, life is fantastic.
So what are sandwiches costing these days in Europe?
You know, people still can afford them. They're not as cheap with the exchange rate as they used to be. But, you know, we're talking from about 3 to 6 euros. So, you know, you can get a great lunch for under 10 bucks. And the great thing about sandwiches, you can take them on a picnic. You know, there's my other favorite place is a little cubbyhole called Le Petit Vendôme in Paris, off Place Vendôme. And there's a line that snakes out the door for the baguette sandwiches. Again, baguette in a very crusty, chewy baguette from Julien, which is one of the best baguettes in Paris. And, you know, just some jambon, some fromage, and you take it to the Tuileries Gardens and you look at the Louvre, and life is beautiful.
The best ham and cheese sandwich imaginable. Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen is author of The New Spanish Table. Her article on the best sandwiches in Europe appeared in the May 2008 issue of Travel and Leisure magazine. Now, to find Anya's sandwich picks, you just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, be sure to check out our newsletters, our podcasts, and information on our new book, inspired by this very show, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. You're going to find it all, you know where. splendidtable.org. Coming up, the making of a wine contrarian and how to enter the blue zone. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. In 1978, Neil Rosenthal opened a small wine shop in New York City. His original idea was to work closely with the people who grew their own grapes and made wine from them. And because of this, he became dedicated to terroir, to wines that were about the place and the people who gave them character. Well, over the years, Neil Rosenthal became one of America's most highly regarded wine merchants and importers. His book is Reflections of a Wine Merchant, on a lifetime in the vineyards and cellars of France and Italy. Neil, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, Lynn.
Neil, how did you get started in the wine business?
It was a very haphazard way. I dropped out of the practice of law and was searching to find something to support myself as I thought I might become a writer, knowing that I couldn't earn a living that way. And I stumbled into the wine business thinking I'd be in it for a little while. And here I am 32 years later, still searching down wine and finally getting to write something.
But from what I understand, from the beginning, you had an approach that was perhaps a tad different than a lot of other people who were selling wine.
The approach, I think, comes from the hubris of overconfidence. So I thought that I could go out and find things that were better than were in the current market, and I went out and did that. And I tracked down small growers. When I say small, I don't mean in stature, but in size of vineyards. And that was my commitment from the very beginning, that I wanted to only work with what we know in the trade as estate-bottled wines, which is to say you work with a grower who grows grapes, harvests grapes, makes wine, and puts his label on it with his own name.
Was this untoward at that time? I mean,
at that time, the business was very much more limited than it is right now, much on a much smaller scale in a certain way, but it was dominated by large producers because they were the only ones with the capacity of getting outside of their local markets and doing things on an international scale, exporting.
Mm-hmm. I would love for you to tell – there's a chapter in the book called The Test.
Yes.
And it's your first trip to Burgundy, and it's your first visit with a Burgundian winemaker. Can you tell the story of that tasting?
Well, it wasn't exactly my first visit, but it was one of the visits in the very beginning part of my quest. I stopped in late one afternoon at a gentleman by the name of Gaston Barteau in the little village of Chambly-Musigny, and the process is really very interesting and not very clear. One stumbles upon somebody, you make your acquaintance, and this testing process goes on where you eventually have to prove to the producer that you're worthy of buying his or her wine, which is to say you have to show a certain mettle, you have to show a certain awareness and ability in front of them, because the nice thing about this kind of transaction, certainly is it's not common, I think, but it's common in my type of business. The nice thing about this is that the relationship that forms is not solely a one about profit. It's certainly everybody wants to make a living, and it's a very, very important, but it's more about understanding that the sole quest is not just to make money, but it's to get involved in a relationship that is going to last for a long time and a relationship that has a profound degree of mutual respect. So what happens is that you go through this process of tasting wine and try and prove to them that you understand what they're showing you, the goods and the bads and the mediocre and your ability to distinguish between them, among them.
So he started you out with what?
Well, we started tasting the whole series of wines that he made. Uh-huh. This was back in 1980, 81. These are the vintages that we were considering, 80, 81, 82. And one goes through this process, and there's a little bit of hidden – not all the information is divulged. One has to ask the right questions. You ask where the wine comes from, which particular site in Chambly-Musigny that has produced this wine, trying to understand the differences amongst all of these wines that you're seeing. And then you'll go back over a series of years. And finally, the ultimate test, as I describe it in the book, is we sit down. We get out of the cellar. We go back into his home, and he comes back with some old wines that don't bear any label. The only costume they have is a mold that comes from the deepest recesses of the cellar. Mm-hmm. He opens the bottle, and my job is to tell him what year it is and what part of the vineyard it comes from.
How did you feel at that moment?
I loved it. It was exciting. It was stimulating. I was exhausted, but I loved the challenge, because at that time it was all about how much one could absorb, how much I absorbed over the years. I could just spill out in that few seconds of ultimate concentration. It's a great thing. It's a great Zen moment when one is really on one's best game.
Did you pass?
Yes, passed with flying colors, one of the moments that actually was great. I don't know if I could do it again 32 years later, but it was one of those nice little epiphanies.
You seem to, after looking at how you work, you seem to look for what I think of as personality in the bottle. Is that getting more difficult these days?
I actually think that we're in a bit of a renaissance right now. I think we passed through a period of about a decade or so where people gave up their right to choose. We became a little bit slavishly entrapped in the media process, which is to say that people would give over their choice of selecting to things that were praised in the press and made it easy for them to, quote, sell wine and to make wine according to some rules that were laid down by others outside of the actual producing sphere. But I sense now there's a new generation involved. I see over the passing of time that there is a revival in all things artisan. We appreciate what values this brings to our life and our culture. And I'm very optimistic about it, actually.
But, you know, I'm thinking about this idea of the international wine, this very fruity, very drinkable when it's young wine, which has become extremely popular. And I personally wonder if this is an American taste, but has the American influence on winemaking, has it had an effect on tastes in Europe?
I think it definitely has. Certainly there has been, if one could say, the taste in wine has been infected by this urge to make things easy mm-hmm. to understand, easy to drink. And for me, the great wines are those that maybe you might have to struggle with in the beginning, but they reveal their charms over time. So I would argue for a little bit more patience, and I think our culture becomes richer because of it.
Do you have an ideal wine?
Well, I think, you know, I've been asked on a couple of occasions over the years what is the one wine that I would drag with me were I to be isolated in some place.
Uh-huh.
And I have this may sound a bit odd to most people. It's a wine that almost nobody knows about. It's a wine called Carema, which is a wine that is made. It's an appellation up in the northwestern corner of Piedmont in the foothills of the Italian Alps.
Yeah, yeah.
Made by my oldest and dearest friend, Luigi Ferrando. Why I love this wine is that it is a good performer all the time. It always gives satisfaction. It's not in your face. It's not that kind of big powerhouse wine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wine of subtlety, a wine of finesse, but something I think the wines of subtlety and finesse are the ones that you can live with over time. And that's really, for me, the great requirement. Something you can go back to over and over and over again and always be satisfied.
Uh-huh. It's a red, I gather.
It is a red wine, very much so, a very great red wine. Although I must say that as I get older, I'm appreciating the great luxurious charms of old white wines as well, because they seem to have a wonderful staying power that one might not imagine exists. I am searching for wines that are structured so that they can age for quite some time, because I think the great wines reveal themselves over time. I often say that wine is a little bit like our children. They're amusing when they're young, but they're much more interesting when they get older. And so for me, the conflict is that the marketplace almost requires one to jump in and taste all these wines right away, make immediate judgments. But the joy of these wines, I think, ultimately is to wait a little bit and watch for the complexity and the nuance, which is, after all, what one pays for, at least what I'm paying for.
Neil Rosenthal, thank you.
Lynn, it is my pleasure, and thank you very much for being interested.
Neil Rosenthal is author of Reflections of a Wine Merchant on a Lifetime in the Vineyards and Cellars of France and Italy. Well, for me, talking about a wine cellar in Burgundy brings back memories of many long drives back and forth from Italy to Brussels. There was one town in Burgundy right off the highway where I used to stop for lunch. And I can't recall the name of the town or the restaurant, but I remember the house salad. Now, you can find my rendition of Roasted Asparagus Potato Salad on the website, splendidtable.org. Imagine having 100 years on this earth, an entire century to love, change, learn, grow, and enjoy. And imagine the taste experiences you could tally up. I mean, maybe in that time you could influence the future in a big way. Or with all that time ahead of you, you could slow down in the beginning and smell the proverbial coffee. So what are your chances of going strong for 10 decades? Explorer and writer Dan Buettner has been researching the lives of people who have done it. His book is The Blue Zone, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who've Lived the Longest. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So describe to me the Blue Zone. What is this thing?
Well, we found four Blue Zones, and they're parts of the world where people live the longest. And we working with National Geographic, set off to find areas that were measurably longer lived. In other words, places where people are reaching age 100 at extraordinary rates, or they have a longer life expectancy. Because, you know, for the average person, only about 6% of how long you live is dictated by your genes. The other 90% or so is dictated by lifestyle. So if we could study these cultures, find out what they do, we'd have a de facto formula for longevity.
You say we. Who are the we? Or who is the we?
Yes. Our first partners were the National Institutes on Aging, part of the National Institutes of Health, and National Geographic. And then we put together a consortium of physicians and medical researchers around the world, the University of Minnesota, Harvard, a couple of institutions in Europe.
So you said four blue zones. Where are they?
Okinawa, Japan, southern part of Okinawa. It's about 800 miles south of Tokyo. The highlands of Sardinia. There's a Bronze Age culture that have been pushed up in the mountains and have lived there since the time of Christ. The Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica, which is just south of Nicaragua in northwestern Costa Rica. And then Loma Linda, California, 80 miles straight east of Los Angeles. I know eyebrows go up.
Loma Linda, California.
Yeah, San Bernardino Valley. But it's specifically among the Seventh-day Adventists. And Adventists have been studied by the National Institutes on Health, or a study financed by them. 30,000 of them for the past three decades, and they found that Adventists live on average about 10 years longer than the average American.
What did you find out about how food plays into this blue zone phenomena?
It definitely plays a part. I think it plays about 25 to 30% of the overall longevity formula. There's no longevity diet, but there are certain foods that you can map to longevity. The big idea, though, when it comes to eating, is to eat a plant-based diet. All of the longest-lived people in the world eat mostly plants. They avoid processed foods, of course. But the trick that they all have are little strategies to keep from overeating. And that's probably a bigger variable in the equation than any specific, you know, magical longevity food.
So what are some of those strategies?
You look at Okinawans, and they start every meal by intoning a 3,000-year-old Confucian adage, Hara Hachi Bu, which simply reminds them to stop eating when their stomachs are four-fifths full. They tend to eat off of smaller plates, and we know from research that people eat off of smaller plates eat fewer calories than those who eat off of big plates. You look in the kitchens of these blue zones, there's never a TV. Families tend to eat together. They tend to discuss the day as opposed to just shoveling in the food. And then kitchens are set up in a way, in many cases, where, you know, of course, they eat junk food too, but the junk food is minimized, where the good food is sort of on display and easy to grab.
Interesting. So any specifics in the diet, like, for instance, Sardinia, anything there that stood out?
The wine in Sardinia. There's a type of varietal known as a Cannonau, made of a Grenache grape. And we had that wine studied. It has three times the level of antioxidants of any wine in the world.
Really?
Their cheese, Pecorino Sardo, is a cheese made from grass-fed sheep's milk. So it tends to be higher in omega-3 fatty acids. A lot of fava beans there. And then goat's milk. Most of these people, the centenarians, have started their day with congealed goat's milk, kind of a yogurt.
What about the Loma Linda people?
They take their diet directly from the Bible. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, where God says he's provided his people seeds, grains, and legumes. So you look at their what they eat, and it tends to be whole grain breads, nut butters. They tend to eat a lot of nuts. We know, for example, that people who eat nuts four times a week, at least 2 ounces a time, live 2 to 3 years longer than people who don't eat nuts. And that's one of the things we use to explain the longevity among the Adventists.
There's also the idea that exercise plays into this?
Yes, but not willful exercise as much as setting up your environment. For most of human history, life expectancy of our species was about age 30. And now, because science has pushed us to 80 or 90, doesn't mean our bodies are really designed to take 80 or 90 years of pounding. So the longest of people tend to walk. Gardening, for example, it's an ideal longevity activity because it reduces stress, it uses the range of motion, and you emerge with organic vegetables from your workout.
You know, we always hear about diet and exercise and health and living longer, but I think there are people who are just born on this earth with, because of the way they're raised or whatever, a greater sense of security or a kind of inner contentment. I mean, doesn't that figure into this, that individual philosophy of life that people have?
Outlook is huge, and some of us are lucky enough to be born with it, but I also think you can proactively seek it or get it into your life. I think having a sense of purpose, the Okinawans call this ikigai, or the Costa Ricans call it plan de vida, but especially at middle age when your children are moved on and your job might be plateaued, to really know why you wake up in the morning, you're going to eat better food, you're going to exercise, you're going to take your medicines, and you're going to be more engaged with the world if you know that sense of purpose as opposed to being rudderless.
One of the things I found striking, and I'd love for you to explain this, there's a tradition in Okinawa called Moai. Could you explain what that is?
Moai is like a mutual support network. When you're 5 years old, your parent will pair you with four or five other five-year-olds, and you're expected to travel through life. So you have this support system. If things go well, if you win the lottery, you have a good crop, you're expected to share. But if a parent dies or a child gets sick or you're depressed, you can always count on this Moai to have your back, so to speak. And this social support network is not only, I think, good for the intangibles, like reducing stress because you know that there's somebody behind you in life.
Yeah.
But also, I managed to get to know a Moai of a group of five women who are over 100. And they get together almost every day, have a little glass of sake, gossip, talk sex. And if one, they do it there too.
God bless.
And if one of them doesn't show up for 3 or 4 days, the other three or four will, you know, hobble over there and check on her friend. And, you know, if they've, she's fallen down or something,
yeah,
there's somebody to watch her.
That's an amazing concept, that idea of outside of the family, that responsibility for a small group of friends
or
people that become friends.
I think the biggest thing you can do to add good years to your life is to surround yourself with the right people. If you choose people who have a spiritual component to their life, who eat right, who do physical activity for recreation, you don't have to think about it. We know that if your three best friends are obese, there's a 50% better chance that you'll be overweight yourself. They know that from the Framingham studies. And the reverse of that is true as well.
So pick people who bring goodness into your – not goodness, but, you know, bring some a certain level of joy and helpfulness into your life.
I think goodness is actually a good word for it, yes.
Hey, Dan, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Dan Buettner is the author of The Blue Zone, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who Have Lived the Longest. You know, as summer comes on, it's not hard to go meatless. Vegetable main dishes are easy, especially vegetable soups that you can eat hot or cold. I mean, once you've got a big pot made, you can eat from it all week. Now, you don't need recipes to make a soup. You just need the logic behind the dish. If you cook together enough different, really flavorful vegetables with a good base of onion, garlic, and wine to open up the character of each ingredient, you're going to get good soup. Now, you can find the guide for how to improvise your own soup and more unabashed ballyhooing of our tome, How to Eat Supper, on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what food costs $2 a piece and is the latest way to trip out at parties? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what food costs $2 a piece and is the latest way to trip at parties? Well, according to the New York Times, it's miracle fruit. Once you've tasted it, anything bitter or sour that you eat afterwards will taste sweet. Miracle fruit is bright red and the size of a large jelly bean. Apparently, it's the party fruit of choice in New York. It's called flavor tripping. You arrive at the party, maybe pay your host for the privilege of tripping. He gives you a miracle fruit, sets out bowls of lemon and lime wedges, and you party on. Scientist and miracle fruit researcher Linda Bartoshuk has not found any dangers associated with miracle fruit, so maybe we've got here the most innocent form of tripping to come down the pike in many a moon.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's get right to your calls. We have got Nancy on the line from Phoenix. Nancy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My question is about beurre noisette. Brown butter.
Right, right.
There was an article in Bon Appetit this past January about brown butter being the flavor of the year. And I have loved this flavor. In fact, probably about a decade ago, I made a brown butter sauce for Thanksgiving Brussels sprouts, and it was wonderful.
That sounds
the
great.
The flavor was wonderful. Well, about a month ago, I made this brown butter for fettuccine with sage sauce. And I thought, what is it? This flavor is not anything like I had years ago. And then about a month ago, too, we went out to a restaurant that had scallops and brown butter. And
right.
Again, the flavor was wonderful. And I'm just wondering, what is the problem? Is it the butter that I'm using?
Well, maybe we should explain to everybody what brown butter is. They
okay.
call it, in French, it's beurre noisette. Noisette actually means hazelnut. And the idea is that you melt your butter and you cook it gently until the solids in the butter actually turn golden brown or a little darker, the color of a toasted hazelnut.
Okay.
And so what you're doing is you're getting that wonderful, rich butter flavor with a hint, just a hint of caramelization behind it. And that's why it's so delicious. And you're saying that what you've had out and what you've created in the past was really great, and now the latest attempt at home hasn't worked.
Right.
Tell me what you did.
Well, I'm using Trader Joe's unsalted butter.
Right.
And then the directions said to melt it down.
Right.
And, you know, leave it in the pan until it gets, I quote, dark amber. Do not burn.
Right,
and
right.
So
and it's a borderline kind of thing.
Yes.
Otherwise, you end up with something called black butter, which, believe it or not, the French like as well.
Okay.
But at any rate, so go on, go on.
So it's said to take, it'll take about 6 minutes.
Right.
Well, after 6 minutes, it wasn't to the stage where I thought it should be from my past experience.
Right, right.
I left it on the burner a little bit longer, maybe 3-4 minutes.
Right.
And it just didn't do it. So I thought, okay, I'm done with it, and then I'll just use the sauce as is.
Mm-hmm.
But the flavor just wasn't there.
Did you add salt?
No, I didn't.
Okay. First of all, you got to add salt.
Okay.
Using unsalted butter is great, but for brown butter, any kind of sauce, that salt is going to make all the flavors pop.
Okay.
The other thing is, do you like the taste of the Trader Joe butter?
I just buy it because it's been a good butter for me, but this is mm-hmm. the first time I'm sure I use it making brown butter. And so I was thinking maybe I should go to Palugra or, you know, Kerrygold.
Yeah, yeah, those butters, the premium butters. I have to tell you something about Plougras. This is my own personal opinion. Plougras, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, this is a butter that has less water in it. Bakers love it because it has, most butter is about 15% liquid. And in pastry making, the less liquid you have, the better. So pastry people adore this butter. It has incredible fragrance. But Nancy, the flavor never comes through for me. The fragrance is dynamite. When I go to put it in my mouth, it's like, what happened? So I don't know, you need to spend the extra money on the Plougra. Kerrygold, which is from Ireland, is a lovely butter. Organic Valley makes a cultured European butter that's really good. Land of Lakes, quite a while ago, Cooks Illustrated, you know, they always do these tastings. They claimed in their tasting the butter they loved was Land of Lakes Ultra Creamy. And I don't know if you get it out in Phoenix or not.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. But the other point is, if you've been using that Trader Joe's butter all along and you've made good brown butter, I think you just need to add the salt.
Okay, I will try that.
Yeah, either that or their butter formula may have changed.
Okay, I will try those tips and... Oh, I just can't wait to get to the stove now.
You go, girl.
Okay.
You take care. Bye. I love it. In case you've never worked with brown butter, it's really easy to do. You do it over modest heat, medium to medium low heat, and you'll see that the butter will gradually turn a lovely, well, the term amber. And you put a little salt in it. Some people like to let it cool down and add a bit of lemon juice. You can rewarm it. And it's just a tablespoon of that over fish for four. That you've just grilled or that you've steamed. It is fabulous. Put it over green beans. Put it over any vegetable. And in a potato, died and gone to heaven stuff. Anyway, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Kathleen calling from Seattle. Kathleen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about preserved lemons. I have been coming across recipes lately that call for preserved lemons.
Yeah.
I don't know much about them. I'm wondering if I can't find them in my local market, can I make them?
Well, you live in Seattle and you just might find them. They're originally from North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I associate them with Morocco. I have a feeling they're maybe used in other parts of North Africa as well. And yes, you can make them. There was a wonderful book that came out in the 70s, and few people have surpassed it, by Paula Wolfrit, who became a very well-known food writer. But this was her first book, and it was called Couscous and Other Good Things from Morocco. And there's a lot of recipes out there. And it's not hard to do. What you need is some time because you have to wait for it to preserve. But this is what a preserved lemon is. It is lemon that has been cut and packed in salt and lemon juice and allowed to cure.
Mm-hmm.
And it develops a tart, salty, sour, almost bitter quality, but nothing duplicates it.
Huh.
And in Moroccan cooking, you'll find it in stews. You'll find it a lot with poultry and lamb.
Mm-hmm.
But just a tiny bit of it seems to explode flavors. You know, you don't have to kill a dish with it because it's very powerful. And the way you make it is, generally, you want organic lemons because you're using the skin.
Right.
You want to scrub them just to be sure there's no wax on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do is you cut the lemon into quarters or into sixths, but don't cut all the way through. So you want them all attached by maybe a half inch or an inch at the bottom.
Okay.
You want a sterilized glass jar. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going to do is, let's say if you've got four lemons, you want about a half a cup of kosher salt.
Okay.
All right? And you're going to pack the salt into the wedges of lemon, and then you're going to pack them into the jar and add salt, not to almost cover them, but you want to have a really generous amount of salt.
Okay.
And then what you do is you cover them with fresh squeezed lemon juice.
Oh, okay.
And you got to keep it covered. Because that's what's going to be a part of the preservative.
Yeah.
And then you leave it at room temperature for about 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
And that, now, once you have them preserved, they'll hold for a year.
Oh, okay.
You do want to keep them. I keep mine covered with lemon juice all the time. I don't want air getting to the lemon,
yeah.
You know. But the other thing is I keep the jar in the refrigerator after a while.
Yeah.
I'm sort of obsessive about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the idea is that the salt and the lemon juice cures the lemon. And now to use it, what you usually do is you rinse it off lightly. But the salt and the acid has permeated the whole thing. And you can cut it and use little bits of it. You can throw a wedge of it into something. But it's really delicious.
Now, do you just use the outer part, or do you actually use
The whole thing.
The whole slice?
The pulp. The pulp. The
pulp too?
Two schools of thought. Some Middle Eastern and North African food writers say that you want to get rid of the pulp. And I think that's because it has so much salt in it.
Yeah.
I sometimes use the pulp. It depends on what mood I'm in.
Okay.
Okay. But I would say the rind without a doubt.
Okay.
So it's really simple. But you just need, you have to think ahead, but make enough for a year, do a jar. And by the way, for people who really love to cook or who are into, Arab or Middle Eastern food or North African food, it's a great gift.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, of course, people I've brought it as a house gift that they just look at me like I'm insane, but that's a whole other issue. But so I think you're going to find them really fun to work with.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You are welcome.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. In the best of all possible worlds, handing someone a plate of food that you've cooked yourself is an act of generosity, an act of connecting with each other. Well, two people in Denver took this concept to its ultimate end. Libby and Brad Berkey created the So All May Eat Cafe. You order, you eat, and you leave what you choose or can in the donation box. Brad joins us. Brad, welcome.
Good morning.
So, Brad, is there a trust fund somewhere in this picture? I mean, how did you come up with this idea?
Unfortunately, no. This idea was developed over a couple of years. Libby and I had volunteered for a long time at different soup kitchens and shelters and realized that we loved to cook and that also that we loved to serve people. And we were trying to figure out, how could we make that service more concrete part of our lives, mm-hmm. a more full-time effort. And we were brainstorming on an airplane flight one day, and this just hit us and said, a cafe with no set price. It's what we have to do.
Well, does it work?
It does. We've just passed our year and a half mark, and since that time we've fed around 10,000 people who come through our doors and had meals and left a fair enough amount that we're able to keep the doors open and pay a small salary and keep the rent paid and electricity on and everything. So,
How do people react when they come?
People that don't know what they're walking into get a pretty surprised look on their face when we tell them how we work. And we try to tell everybody who comes in the door just so that they don't walk out and not get the full experience. So
yeah.
We do give a quick introduction to anybody who comes in that kind of looks lost. And then overall, it's been a very positive response. There's been a few people who decided that wasn't their gig and they've left. But mm-hmm. overall, very positive, very, very good response.
Are there suggested prices on the menu?
There's no suggested price. We were asked at one time to come up with a range mm-hmm. of a fair price,
right.
And so we did that for a while. We had a range of between $5 to $15 for a full meal, or if you're having a partial meal, feel free to leave anything less than that. But we've recently taken that down because we just felt like there was too much pressure there. People were still feeling like they were required to leave, between
right.
5 and 15.
Right.
The way it works is the donation box is just sitting on the counter. It's very understated. There's no nobody watching it, nobody making sure that everybody uh-huh. who comes in, visits the box or anything. So it's totally anonymous, and I think that relieves some of that embarrassment, and that's why we made it that way, because we wanted everybody to be comfortable to, come in and eat, participate however they could, and not have to have any kind of pressure on them.
What kind of food do you do?
We do mostly organic soups, salads, pizzas, and cookies.
Sounds great. So what's next for you guys?
Oh, gosh. Probably just a little more expansion of hours. I've recently become full-time here. For the first year and a half, I had a part-time job where I was going downtown and doing some IT work after uh-huh. we closed the restaurant. So
right.
now that I'm full-time at the cafe, probably looking at just expanding hours, being here a little more full-time, developing the menu a little bit more fully, and just looking forward to many more years of success.
May there be copycats around the country.
We hope so. We've had lots of interest from folks in different parts of the country, out west, some out east, that are considering doing this very same thing.
Oh, that would be a great idea. Brad, thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Brad Berkey and his wife Libby are the creators and cooks at Denver's So All May Eat Cafe. Now, for more information on their project, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Epicurus. He said, "We should look for someone to eat and drink with before looking for something to eat and drink." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Poetry Foundation, in support of poetry on American Public Media programs. More information online at poetryfoundation.org. Information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and a newly formed collection of inexpensive recipes we're calling Cheap Eats, gathered from our recipe archive. Don't miss out, guys. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin and Judy Graham. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.